just about where we left off, mm-hmm. a little bit before we left off last mm-hmm. time, and backtrack a little bit to your son was had gone back east with your mother by the time you started the fall semester at UCLA. Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
41.
Yes, I'm 41.
And then you went through the fall semester.
And he came back around Thanksgiving time.
Oh, it was just for a short period.
It was from April, right after his birthday. Actually, the beginning of May, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Just a few days after his birthday in April. He went back east to stay with my sister in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, until November of that year. And I'm not sure, just November, right around Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came back and stayed, you know.
And then you during the winter, was it actually a vacation break or the end of a semester?
That I went to work.
It was that you went to work?
He came back in November. Then Pearl Harbor was December 7th. And Christmas recess at UCLA began about December 13th, I imagine. And then I got a job for Christmas recess, I thought, at this toy manufacturing company. And right after Pearl Harbor, everything got very excitable around here. And they were making these laminated badges. You know, there just wasn't much sale for them until all this happened. Or there was, really, because there was a peacetime draft, you know, before that. So we did have armed services and what war work before there was any war, certainly, because men were being hired in droves out there at Blocky. All these months previous to this, then there became immediately there was some kind of I'm not sure, but I'm sure there was a law passed that people had to have identification because of the number of Japanese that were employed. I remember especially Firestone Rubber Company, where we did badges and not only war plants but other direct war plants, making airplanes and that sort of thing. But others, the related industry, like the rubber industry, where the people were needed to be identified, they thought, more securely, where they take the picture and put it in the laminating process, put it in, they couldn't tear it apart and put a different picture in. So they immediately got some contracts at toy manufacturing and asked me to stay beyond the 3 weeks that we generally had for Christmas recess. And so I decided to do that.
Did you, at that point, I mean, given Pearl Harbor, did you begin to think about quitting school anyhow?
Yeah, everything happened right at once. I mean, Pearl Harbor was just a few days before mm-hmm. Christmas recess.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately connected the job and the fact that we were going to war plants, and everything became very patriotic right then. And given the chauvinism of the time, we thought we'd go in and wipe out, you know, whatever was wrong in very short order. So I thought it would be maybe an interruption. Already it was December. I thought, well, by the next fall, certainly everything would be, you know, straightened out, and I'd be back at school. And it was a chance to get some money, to be patriotic, and I had a lot of pluses, so I
mm-hmm.
decided to do that.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you, like people in Los Angeles generally, and you among them, were kind of caught up in that initial war fever.
Oh, immediately caught up in a war fever. It was just really, it was so startling to think that, you know, that somebody had actually dropped bombs on our boys, as we referred to them in those days. And it was just very startling, particularly, I think, maybe even particularly for those of us on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Do you remember feeling fearful?
No, I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that I really felt very careful.
You mentioned the Japanese workers at the tire companies.
Mm-hmm.
When, it was into 42 when the Japanese were evacuated.
Yeah.
Then. Do you recall knowing about that at all?
It was very little. I don't remember finding out. I found out very little. I think it was not very well publicized, the fact
mm-hmm.
that they were doing. And I don't think many of us really knew what exactly was going on. We thought they were being moved, you know, away from the coast, really.
Mm-hmm.
I personally was not aware that they were putting behind barbed wire and
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually putting them in concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
That came out later.
So you worked basically in this job. It was primarily an office job, wasn't it?
It was assembling the things, planning and I was planning the materials to go. I was going along with the photographer and helping with the photography and that sort of thing. It varied. Mm. Also, delivering things. You know, the woman. I mean, I did. It was a very small group of persons, so we all did really just about everything needed to be done. They never going to expand, and I didn't really like it. It was a small group of people, and I didn't like the. I just didn't like working, so I decided to work at Lockheed.
Do you recall how much you were paid at that time?
Yes, I was making $18.50 a week, and they offered to pay me $22.50 a week. That's why I couldn't turn it down. Mm-hmm. It was just too much money.
Oh, after the school break, you mean?
Yeah, they said if you'll stay, you know, we'll give you 20. I forget, $22.50, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it was. Mm-hmm. But I know it was $18.50 a week to begin with, for the 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I was going to get more responsibility, I was going to be the manager, the operation in the in-house operation.
Now, what did you do for child care during that period after your son came back in November?
Well, I had, right during Christmas vacation, that mother took care of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the first of the year, I got married, and I hired somebody to come in and stay with the mother's helpers. In those days, we had mother's helpers, and they would, for room and board and $10 a month, they would, stay around and take care of the baby.
Oh, you got married. That was suddenly.
Yeah, right.
Tell me about meeting your husband.
That had been, I'd known him for over a year, mm-hmm. more than a year. He was another friend of my brother's. He was a friend of my brother's, and, we just dated for all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time that Jeff was back east, really. And then we split up because he drank, and right around the time when Jeff came back, and he decided to give up drinking forever, and I believed him. Not knowing about alcoholism at the time, and we got married in January, right after Christmas reset, in January of 42.
Mm. Now, what did he do?
He was he was an artist, really, a starving artist, but he got a job at Lockheed, so that's really what put him in the mind to go.
Oh, I see.
I think that's probably what made me be aware of the kinds of jobs there were. They seemed to have so much fun.
Mm. So where were you after you married, then where were you living?
Just in Hollywood, in the same place, you know. Ah. My sister still lived there, and that's her mother. And see, my sister lived there. My mother paid the rent, you know, before. And I did housework all the time during the summer and mm-hmm. part-time, and also worked at the Times with my surveys when those days came along. That was instead a full-time job,
mm-hmm.
just part-time. So, you know, we just sort of catch-as-catch-can to get the rent to you. So when I had a regular salary, I just couldn't turn that down. It was a big, marvelous thing to me. And let's see, where was I? Oh.
So then
Jimmy and I decided to get married. We decided. He decided that, you know, we could stop drinking, you know, if we were married and regularized our status and that sort of thing, then everything would be just fine. And we did marry then in January.
And then, but you stayed in the same apartment, in other words?
Yeah, we moved shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. I don't remember, that's been 30 years ago, mm-hmm. more than that. 40, almost 40 years ago. Then.
But this mother's helper would actually live in?
Yes, she did.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Then we moved over on Gardner Street, come to think of it, where there were two bedrooms. And the mother's helper and Jeff had one room, and Jimmy and I the other, yeah.
So and then he was working at Lockheed, and you were still at the toy.
At the toy manufacturer, yeah. Uh-huh.
What did he do at Lockheed?
He was assembling. He was riveting and mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
And he drove from, or he went from Hollywood to the Burbank plant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, had he been working at Lockheed when?
I don't remember when. He was there before Pearl Harbor. They,
mm-hmm.
they began hiring. Oh, I think the year he might have been there. A year, so I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. A lot of the young men wanted to go there because they were given deferments, draft deferments.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he wanted the job because he was, you know, very, very broken. He enjoyed it. And of course, he liked it. You know, he had mm-hmm. a good time. It was fun.
Now, Then you continued at the toy?
Only into January, maybe a month, I'm not sure, even more than that. Because it was uncomfortable there. I didn't really like it. It wasn't fun to do. And Jimmy said, why don't you come out to Lockheed? And I tried that. And they said that they had nothing that would be mutually satisfactory, they thought. So why didn't I go to Frank Wiggins and learn sheet metal layout, learn some sheet metal skills, and then come back?
Now, they specifically recommended the sheet metal skills, though.
Yeah. So,
did you have any notion of what they were talking about?
Not at the time. I'm not sure that they said sheet metal skills.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know what they said. They probably told me exactly what to take. Mm-hmm. You know, because they were forming. It wasn't like going down and enrolling and going into sheet metal, that sort of thing. These were things that the classes group specifically designed to train people to go to work at the war plants,
mm-hmm.
as we call them.
Now, how did you enroll there? Did you have to pay for that class at all?
Well, Frank Wiggins is a junior college, and they're free. You know, that you pay, even now, you pay like $10 a semester, so it can't have been very much then to go there.
Now, can you describe, do you remember what the training program was like?
We had I don't really remember, probably 20 persons in the group. And we were taught various, you know, this is a piece of aluminum, of alclad, and you are going to rivet this to another piece of alclad. First off, we're going to drill holes in it. They taught us how to lay it out. Now to use scribes to mark out so we could, you know, for most people, certainly for me, close was good enough. You know, we didn't really know about measuring precisely, and that's important to know in a war plant. So we learned to measure precisely, to lay it out, to drill. It looks easy to drill, but it isn't until you get used to it. You have an electric motor with a drill bit in it. And we learned to drill without making egg-shaped holes and that sort of thing. And then to put in the rivet of various kinds of rivets, and how to upset it. The air guns take a little getting used to. You know, you do the big. You don't think about riveting?
Just what I've read.
Oh yeah. Well, it's you learn to control the air, the pneumatic hammer, so that the rivet will become they call it upsetting, so you can upset the head of the rivet without making it too low, too high, you know, just not having it crooked. You can you can get it all crooked, and then you have a hell of a time with that. So we just really learned riveting. We learned all kinds of, we had many different kinds of little projects.
Mm-hmm.
We learned about clecos, you know, the things that hold them together.
Mm-hmm.
We learned about matching up holes, and we had just lots of different little projects.
Were you taught on rather small pieces?
Yes.
Of,
oh, yeah.
Of metal?
Oh, yeah.
So would you, in learning the riveting and in practicing the riveting, would you do your own bucking?
Oh, no, you can't do that.
Uh-huh.
Somebody on the other side has to buck.
Mm-hmm.
You have, you always have a riveter and a bucker, somebody with the air hose. Somebody, a bucking bar is like a piece of metal that you hold on the other side. And you have to hold it right. The bucker has to learn how to do that so that it doesn't get crooked, too. So we learned both things to do. We partnered with it, sort of thing.
So it really was, basically the training was on installation technique.
Well, yeah. Not that isn't really installation, that's manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, or assembly.
Yeah, assembly. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So it wasn't sheet metal.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. And we had to learn how to form it up. We had to learn how to use the brakes, you know. And we didn't, and some router, we'd have router projects, you know, a lot of different, we certainly didn't have a power press, I didn't think we did. I don't really remember our having that, but with the various kinds of things that you would use in the plant.
How long was the training class?
As I recall, it was about 2 months. I don't really remember. I think it was 6 weeks, 2 months.
Was it full days?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, I don't remember that either.
Mm.
Probably not full days.
Now, was there any aptitude testing done before they let take the class?
No, these were in the days now when we didn't really have aptitude tests. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were just developing things like that. Mm-hmm. I might have had to do something, but I really doubt it. Mm-hmm. Because I doubt that I'd have gotten in and I had to pass a test, never having seen a ribbon gun or anything like that before.
Do you recall what your first feelings were about using the machinery?
Yeah, just sheer joy. I just loved it. Yeah.
I just couldn't
even imagine anything better than this. You know, I thought, God, this is so much fun.
Oh.
And we did have fun. Mm-hmm. It was just really fun.
What, now, how many of the 20 people taking the class, what percentage of them would you say were women?
I don't have any recollection. I would say certainly not half. Mm-hmm. Not then. See, this was right after, just a few months after Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And still they were hiring men for these jobs. So I'm sure there were not very many of us. One other thing I did there was I had an aptitude. I mean, my aptitude for this kind of thing showed up. And I would finish up my projects early. And the guy, the man in charge of the tool crib, mm-hmm. you know what the tool mm-hmm. crib is, where you take things out and then different mm-hmm. tools back, and he let me help him, and that way I learned the names of all the tools.
Oh.
I learned to spot different, you know, how to spot different size drills and that sort of thing. Mm. And so it was, there were a lot of different things to learn, and he was very nice and taught me all those things. So I had that, and I, in addition to just the other skills, I had a lot of the language, a lot of the vocabulary.
Well, it sounds like the physical setup of the training program was basically a replication of the factory with
right.
the tool crib, and
yeah,
instead
right.
of just having you sit somewhere and do
yeah.
the project.
Yeah, right. Oh, definitely.
Uh-huh.
And they learned to, we learned to go to the tool crib and ask for what we wanted, mm. to find the sheets. They gave us sheets about whatever we were going to do, and we were supposed to be able to learn, you know, what we needed in order to do these.
Oh, so you were basically, in effect, doing your own, I don't know if in that case it would be called setup, but basically you were doing your own setup. Just given a bunch of ribbons and told this is the section you're going to do.
Oh, no, no,
so
no.
it was much
no.
more extensive training
oh, sure,
than later.
Oh, sure, yeah, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we learned to do our own stuff because everyone did before the war. You know, mm-hmm. it was much more individualized than it was. It was certainly streamlined and afterwards. It had to be because previous to the war, the men who worked at Lockheed or in the war plants were, you know, basically mechanics. Mm-hmm. You know, they really were, they were craftsmen. They were individually able to do the things that they were supposed to do instead of having things chopped down to the point where there was just some little something
mm-hmm.
that, to do that didn't require a lot of skill. But remember, you know, immediately the country geared for war and needed, you know, hundreds of airplanes and hundreds of spare parts. As they were being shot off, we made many, many spare parts for our airplanes, and whom were they to hire of all people who had no skill?
Mm-hmm.
So things had to be changed mm-hmm. very rapidly to...
But it sounds like you were given more skill, training for more skill.
We were.
Than
those of us who went through Frank uh-huh. Wiggins were indeed given a great deal more, much more than the people later whom I taught in at Lockheed.
Uh-huh.
Because they still were not used to the idea, you know, of streamlining it even further,
mm-hmm.
making the tasks even smaller mm-hmm. and smaller, each job smaller.
Now, was your assumption that when you finish this class that you would definitely get a job?
Well, they didn't say that. They said, then we'll see. You know, mm-hmm. they certainly didn't promise because they had no way of knowing whether or not I'd learn to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went back, you know, with my grades and recommendation from the school, and they hired me at once. So I went for
now. You had? Did they give you a certificate at the completion of the course?
They did, and I haven't. I'm sure that it must be somewhere. I don't know where it is, but I haven't seen it for many, many years. But they did give a mm-hmm. certificate of completion.
Now, do you remember? Then, when you finished, you went to apply for the job.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what the interview process was like, or the screening process for the job?
No, I don't. Frightening, of course, you know. I didn't know if I'd get it or not. I really wanted to. I liked it. And I, you know, then I'd blown the whole semester at UCLA, so I thought, you know, I wanted to the whole rest of the year, really. By then, it was mm-hmm. much too late to go back to school.
Well, and so, you also, during that interim, had no income, did you?
No, therefore, I know I must have... Jimmy, by then I was married. So maybe Jimmy might have supported us. I don't know. He probably did.
Mm.
But, or I might have been part-time. Probably didn't do Saturday work, part-time work,
mm-hmm.
to help out. But see, I forget what you asked me.
Well, do you recall how long the period was between the time that you finished the class and then actually began working, or went to
very just a few days? You know, just uh-huh. you know, we went. I was the man in charge, and I don't remember whether it was an instructor or the children man or whatever. I finished my projects. They told me, since I'd done them very well, that, you know, I could finish up. We worked individually or in pairs, whichever, on our projects, our assigned. You do this and you do that, and you get another sheet and you do the next mm-hmm. thing, or next progressive thing that you're to learn. And I was able to finish up, you know, maybe half a week before the others, and they said, if you finish up, you can go.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was able to go back to Lockheed and apply before all 20 of us descended on the thing. So I was very lucky.
Now, do you recall any sort of interviewing process or any sort of testing, physical exams, any of that?
Oh, physical,
procedure?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. once, you know, they had that evidence that I had taken the course, so they had passed it. So they knew that my skills, you know, would fit in with what they had to do. And then after, I don't know, I don't remember any other kind of test. I doubt that we had any other kind of tests to take. Just an interview, mm-hmm. and then, of course, physical. You had a complete physical, which they paid for. It was right. You went there and had it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you passed the physical, you were in.
And then was there any lag time between passing the physical and starting to work?
But I don't think so, because they were very eager for us, and they really needed us.
Do you recall what you were told about the job when you went through the hiring process, in terms of what it would be, how much you would get paid?
Oh, yeah, told how much you'd pay, what department it would be, and it would probably be riveting. And when I got to the department, I know they had me, instead of riveting, which I thought was, you know, just loads of fun, they had me drilling in a drill jig. Now, drill jig is, do you know what that is? A drill jig is something that fits over the part, and it has bushings through which you stick your drill so that the holes go the right place. And it was still, things were still geared to men who tend to be taller than women. So I was standing up, you know, and where a man would have had an easier time of it, you know, I was holding it up like shoulder high and breaking drills like mad because I, you know, I'd tilt.
Was this at a bench rather than...
No, we're standing up.
You were standing
up? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I talked to them. We had lead men, and that was the first person, was over here. And I said, but they told me I'd be riveting. And he said, oh, do you really want to rivet? So if he found me a job, he after a few days,
mm-hmm.
he found me a job riveting on the tail cone. He said, I'm sure he was glad to get me off the drill jig, and I was very glad to get off.
Do you recall, Glad, what it was like that first day walking into the factory, what your impressions were?
I'm sure awe, surprise. I hadn't, you know, it was so big. Felt cold. You know, just not cold, but I don't know. It was fascinating to me. I've always liked new things to do. Frightening, certainly, fear. Maybe I won't be able to do it right, and you know what's going to happen. It's very frightening. It was really my first, you know, real job. Really, yeah, really, real job. It's very scary. I remember women had rest breaks, two a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. We were allowed 15 minutes, and as well as a lunch break, which was half an hour. I remember when launch break came, I thought surely it had to be time to go home. I do remember. I remember thinking, oh my God, I'll never be able to stay.
How did you prepare before that first day in terms of clothing?
They told us exactly what we had. We had to wear slacks. We had to wear nets or something in our hair so that it wouldn't get. We had to wear slacks of some sort.
Did you have any or did you have to buy some?
Oh, I'm sure I had some. And I don't remember going and buying any in particular. Maybe I did, but I don't remember that. And nets I certainly had to buy. We had to wear nets or snoods or something of that sort to keep our hair, because I had long hair at the time, and long swinging hair. It's most 22-year-olds did in those days. They told us about, rings, being aware of rings, loose clothing. There were always signs all over, mm-hmm. be careful about loose clothing, for the men, too.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to bring in any of your own tools that first day?
No, I don't think we ever did. Mm. I think it's just everything.
Now, do you recall how you were assigned, say, coming in that first day, you clocked in. Did mm-hmm. someone then take you to your assigned location?
I don't remember that. I don't remember. They might have probably gave us, they wouldn't have had a map, I don't imagine. I think later, though, they did. Or maybe somebody met us and brought us in. Mm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. On most jobs, people don't. I guess maybe they do, don't they? Bring you in and show you around. I don't know if they do or not. I don't recall.
Do you recall any reaction from the men, since you were among the really first women going in there?
Well, whistles and things like that. Mm-hmm. But not as much as you'd think.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a lot of comments and remarks. Now they're talking about sexual hassling on the job, and I think already above. It was just expected in those days. We never thought to complain about.
Mm-hmm. And what was the reaction of the lead man who basically put you in place?
He was very nice. He was really a very likable. He was very young, and he was very short. His name was Audie, and I don't remember his last name. And he was just really an awfully nice. Very nice to me. He was, he understood that because he was short, I'm sure he can, feel my tiredness. And I liked, there was, he had he put me to work on the tail cone, on the P2V, the PV2, I mean. That was the one in a series of planes that Lockheed made. It was a small 2-engine, I think, plane. And the tail cone was, you know what the tail cone is like, was set up like this, mm-hmm. over on a platform. And
so it was set on end,
yeah.
In other words.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And it was set up on, on a platform so that underneath the bucker could get inside, which meant then that I had to have steps to go up and down on the outside. So it was, it was really a lot of fun to do that. We had a good time.
So you only worked on the drill press?
No, we got the drill press. Drill jig.
Drill jig for a couple of days.
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
And then I worked on the tail cone for I don't recall how long.
How were you assigned the bucker? Do you recall when you...
No, I think she came. I think she came with the job. I don't know if she came. It was a woman by then, too. And I don't know if she was... there, I don't remember whether she was already on the job and the riveter moved on to something else, or whether she was newly assigned to that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Now, how large a section then of the tail cone was it? Was it the full cone?
The cone. The tail cone was about probably as big as the chair over there, about that size. That pretend there's mm-hmm. a cone over that chair.
So
then that comes up to a point, almost to a point.
So about 3 feet by...
About 3 feet coming to a point.
To a point.
Mm-hmm. Like a pyramid rather mm-hmm. than, except a round, like a cone.